Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
You don't have to celebrate the holiday to understand that a wide swath of Canada is pretty fertile ground for growing Christmas trees. If you've ever driven through suburban farmland, you've probably seen a Christmas tree farm. Row upon row of perfect little triangular conifers, each spaced out for maximum boughs. And if you do celebrate Christmas, and you have purchased one of these trees in recent years, you might get the sense that it's getting harder to grow them so perfectly. The price of Christmas trees is rising quickly because the job of farming them is getting complicated. Not so complicated yet that they are disappearing, but complex enough that farmers are considering their options. Some families are considering just getting a plastic tree. And today, we're considering the industry as a whole. Just what goes in to growing Christmas trees so perfectly? What's changing? What comes next? And what's the difference between a farmed tree and the kind that you'd just go in the woods and chop down? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is a special holiday episode of The Big Story. Richard Hamlin is a professor at the University of British Columbia, where he heads up the Department of Forest Conservation Sciences. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
We're going to talk about Christmas trees today because it's close to Christmas and most of us have either visited or driven past a Christmas tree farm. I think we all kind of know the look of them, but maybe you can tell us a bit about like how big a business it is in this country.
So it's actually not a small business, but it's not a big business either. So if you compare it to, the forest industry, for example, because the trees that we use in Christmas tree farms are often the same trees that we plant out in natural forest for our reforestation program. And the forest industry is about a $35 billion contribution to the GDP every year. So that's a big business. Mm-hmm. By comparison, the Christmas tree industry brings about $100 million per year. So it's not a small business, but it's dwarf compared to the forest industry.
What about raising Christmas trees? Like, I assume that you don't just plant them in the lines there and let them grow. Like, what kind of process goes into creating the trees that we would traditionally buy in big cities from, you know, grocers or other plant dealers?
So it's actually kind of a funny business because it's sort of a hybrid between forestry and agriculture. So most of the trees, Christmas trees that we buy are grown on plantations or on farms, very similar to an agriculture operation, much more than a forestry operation. It kind of sounds simple, right? You go to a Christmas tree farm and you see those trees and think like, oh, you know, it must be easy to do. You can just plant some trees in the ground, let them grow.
Right.
But it's actually a complex business with lots of challenges and risk because it's kind of a long-term investment. So the Christmas tree farmers, first they have to get the right seedlings, because they don't plant seeds, they plant seedlings, so the little trees, and they have to pick the right species because not all species will grow properly in all the sites. So they have to look at the soil, they have to look at the climate, pick the right species, mm-hmm. and then they put these seedlings in the ground, and they got about 6 to 12 years of work ahead. So it's not like you just sit back and watch them grow. And that work is intensive. I mean, they have to shear or prune because, you know, this beautiful conical shape that these Christmas trees have?
Yeah.
That's what conifers look like, right? They have that conical shape naturally. But if you ever look at the naturally growing conifer, it's actually, you know, much more sparse, the branches. So in an 8-foot tall tree that you would put in your house for a Christmas tree, maybe you would have only about 20 branches. So what the Christmas tree growers have to do, they have to prune and shape those trees, kind of an exaggerated conical shape that's not really natural. So they have to, you know, clip the tips and make sure that, you know, the shape is right. So that's kind of very intensive and you know, kind of hard work. And on top of that, they have to remove competing vegetation. So they have to weed out, you know, you've seen those plantations, right? They, you know, there's just these Christmas trees and kind of grass around it. So, So that's because they actually remove the weeds. They don't want competing trees around or competing, you know, vegetation. And then they give fertilizer. So they actually, you know, give food to those Christmas trees so that they grow faster. Often they have to also treat against pests and diseases, because that's the other reality of growing these trees in you know, in this perfect environment. They're really attractive to pests and diseases. So you know, all in all, it's a very sort of intensive operation. They have to be there all year round, and they have to repeat it every year, because it takes, depending on the size of trees and where you are, you know, 6 to 10 to 12 years. To produce a tree. So yeah, it's a lot of work.
You mentioned there's risk involved when you're planting trees like this. How so?
So some of the risks have to do with some of the weather events that we've seen recently. You put a tree in the ground and you got 10 years and then you don't know what the weather is going to be like. It might change. It might, you know, you might have these crazy weather swings that we've seen that are associated with climate change. So that's a huge risk that they have to face. We've seen everything from drought, flooding, the heat dome. So it's been, you know, this has been really, really hard for Christmas tree growers. Drought seems to be the worst because especially the type that we've had recently, these, you know, extreme droughts, long number of days without rain. Also on top of that, the heat dome, the heat that it basically was baking the needles. So this kind of combined effect was really, really hard on the seedling. We know that, you know, Christmas tree grower has to put seedlings in the ground and they harvest. So they kind of try to keep a balance between what they harvest and what they put in the ground. And those small seedlings that you put in the ground, they don't have these well-developed root systems, and they're particularly susceptible to drought, because the drought, it dries out at the top of the soil first, and the bigger trees can, you know, can have their roots are a little bit deeper. They can go and get the water, a little bit of water there is deep in the ground, but those small seedlings, they don't have that luxury, so they're kind of stuck there on the topsoil with their little root systems, and they're the ones that suffered the most. And that's, you know, so that's been really hard on some of the Christmas tree growers, who've lost some of them up to 70% of their new seedlings. And for them, well, that's their future crop. So those are the trees, not the ones that they will sell this year, but that they'll sell in 10 years. So that's a big, this is the kind of risks that they're facing in the future.
I'm glad you mentioned the difference between like the seedlings and already mature trees. What about the difference between the way farmed trees are planted versus trees that grow naturally in a forest? You mentioned they're used for reforestation. Are those trees at the same kind of risk as the farm trees, and why or why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, most of my work in my professional life is conducted on trees in natural forests, and their, you know, their health and how they are affected about, you know, pests and diseases and climate change. So we know a lot about that. But you know, some of the same species are used. For example, Douglas fir is a tree that's used a lot in Christmas tree plantation, but it's also a tree that we plant a lot in British Columbia, and for reforestation. It's a very valuable tree species. So, and we know that Douglas fir is a tree species that's going to be, it might in some ways benefit from climate change, because it, you know, we're now kind of helping it to migrate to to areas that are going to be better, like with a better fit in the future climate. So we can predict what the future climate is going to be. And then we can move the trees looking at their genetic profile, and we can move them to the areas where the climate is going to be right in the future. So for trees that we grow in the forest, we have time. You know, they're going to grow for maybe 70, 100 years, which we don't have for Christmas trees. So that's right. One big difference. The other big difference, I should say, is that if you look at a natural forest, it's a community, it's an ecosystem. You have different tree species, there are different sizes, and you have, you know, we hear a lot about that lately, the all these mycelial networks, these symbiotic fungi that connect the roots together. And all this is making natural forests more resilient. There could be some species suffer but from drought, for example, but others will, you know, take over. And you get also some shading. You get some, you know, the seedlings, some of them will grow under the shade of the bigger trees. Right. So if you look at the Christmas tree farm, are completely opposite of everything I just said. Basically, it's all, you know, very young trees, same age, all very exposed. I'm guessing, I don't think anyone has looked at that, but I'm guessing that because they space them out, that the mycorrhizal connections are probably much less. So less ability to, you know, share resources and get more, you know, nutrients from the soil. Mm-hmm. So these are very, very different ways of growing trees from a natural balance, you know, ecosystems where there's biodiversity to a basically monocultures that is completely exposed. So I think that's maybe what we're seeing, this kind of impact that we've seen with the drought, you know, killing so many seedlings and affecting so many trees in Christmas plantation. Maybe this is sort of a preview of what's going to happen later in the forest if we don't, you know, if we don't do things right.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I know you're not necessarily a business analyst, but just mm-hmm. given what you've seen with these trees and how they respond, especially in a farm situation, as we see more heat domes, more droughts, more extreme weather, is what's going to happen to the Christmas tree industry? Like, is it sustainable?
Well, I kind of think it is because there's some potential for, you know, doing things differently. But, you know, one thing that's for sure is that the, you know, what I said about a lot of those seedlings being the trees of the future dying. So we should expect that this shortage of Christmas tree, it's not going to get better because it takes 10 years to grow trees. So if we're running out of them now and if they're dying because of the heat, it's going to be worse in the future. I kind of take that as a given, and also that the price is going to go up. So in a way, the farmers, Christmas tree farmers who can survive this, well, they can charge more and maybe make more money, maybe. Mm-hmm. But there's some other solutions, maybe sort of taking a page from the book of this, what we do in a natural forest, where we try to do this, you know, assisted migration, try to help trees grow in climates that where they're going to be better adapted in the future. So this same approach could be used for Christmas trees. And I know that some people are looking into that, trying to find, you know, genetically more drought and disease resistant individuals within species so that they can actually select them. But there's also some people and more are actually picking for Christmas tree farm trees that are different tree species. And this is where it's a little bit controversial because they're different tree species, but they're not native. Like, you know, all the Christmas trees that we know usually, you know, the Douglas fir, the balsam fir, the pines, you know, like they're our native trees that mm-hmm. that grew in the forest, and we also farm them. But more and more, you see Christmas tree farmers who get trees from other parts of the world where there's more drought, and thinking that these trees are going to be better adapted to the future Canada, where it's going to be drier. And some of those trees, they're fir. So if you see them, you're going to think like, well, this is a nice fir, nice Christmas tree with nice, you know, nice shiny needles and good smell. But they come from a region, the Caucasus, like the Black Sea, you know, countries like Turkey, for example, and Georgia. And these are places where, you know, the latitude is 40 degrees, about the same latitude as Northern California. And there's some fir there that grow, and they're really resistant to drought and to diseases. They have this thick, waxy layer on the needles that allows them to lose less water. And so these have become popular, and you can already buy them in the U.S. to grow them. In Europe, they grow them a lot. So this may be, you know, part of the future of Christmas tree farms is to adapt to grow either, you know, pick Douglas fir that will be more drought resistant and more disease resistant, or, you know, plant other species that, in a way, like these other species, like natural selection has done its work mm-hmm. over the millions of years. You know, these trees have been selected for these drier and hotter environments. So nature has done its job. So it's kind of easy for us to take those trees instead of trying to do the selections ourselves, although that's also a good option. And this is something that's been done in Douglas fir, for example.
Let me ask you a question as a conservationist. Should we be farming Christmas trees at all, especially now that you're talking about bringing in non-native species, which I know is something some environmentalists argue fiercely against now that we're using valuable resources? Should we not just be reforesting everything and not worrying about farms?
Well, the reforesting we already doing. I mean, we should not forget that we planting in Canada, we plant 500 million seedlings every year, most of them conifers, in our reforestation program. So we plant a lot of trees
right.
compared to the number of Christmas trees that we put in the ground. And, you know, the government of Canada made a commitment to plant 2 billion trees on top of those 500 million trees. So, you know, they're planted to become forests and to fix carbon. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily in conflict.
Okay.
Because also we should remember that the Christmas tree farm often... they are, especially Quebec and Ontario, maybe less so in BC, but Quebec and Ontario, a lot, and Nova Scotia, a lot of those Christmas tree farms are on farms where some of the land was abandoned. Maybe there was marginal land. And, you know, growing trees on there actually plays a good role in terms of fixing carbon and generating oxygen. That's what,
right.
That's what trees do. So you know, it's not, these are not in conflict. I think we can do both.
This has been a fascinating look at a subject that I've always wanted to know more about. So thank you for that. I have one more question for you though, which is if you have a tree, what tree do you have? Do you use plastic? Do you use a farm tree? Do you go out and cut your own down?
Well, I'm an unconditional team natural trees. I've never had a plastic Christmas tree, and that's because, you know, it's a product that's entirely made by nature, biodegradable. So it's almost too good to be true if you think of a decoration product, right? And also I was raised in Quebec, and my dad had a woodlot, and my favorite childhood memories was, you know, going out on the woodlot at Christmas with our axe and our saw and picking our Christmas tree, cutting it down ourselves. They were usually ugly and they didn't have too many branches, but just it was just such a fun thing to do. And I've continued doing that with my son. So definitely for me, it's not just the fact that it's a biological product, but it's also, especially if you do it yourself, if you cut your own tree, it's kind of a nice thing to do. you kind of feel closer to nature. And then you bring nature into your house, mm-hmm. these great smells and, you know, it feels like the right thing to do.
I have very fond memories of my grandfather doing the exact same thing on a farm in Quebec. So it's a beautiful way to end it, except now I live in Toronto, so I just paid $100 for a tree.
Well, 100 is not bad because it's going to get more expensive.
Oh, man.
Do you know what kind of tree you got?
Yeah, it's a Douglas fir.
Douglas fir. Well,
it's quite nice. And it has clearly been cut to have that nice cone shape.
Very nice.
Richard, thank you so much for this. Appreciate the time.
You're welcome. That was nice talking.
Richard Hamnan of the University of British Columbia. That was the big story. Yes, there's probably news going on in the world this week before the holidays. But as I said last week, we wanted to bring you guys some nice things as we get ready to say goodbye to this long year. Hopefully you've enjoyed the first in our series of episodes chosen by members of the Frequency Podcast Network team. We will have the rest of the Staff Pick series, as well as a couple more surprises for you over the next couple weeks. And of course, we are taking your feedback for what you want covered when we get back to brand new episodes in January. You can find The Big Story at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. And you can call us and leave a voicemail, 416-935-5935. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Have a happy holiday, whichever one you're celebrating. And we'll talk in a couple of days.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.